When we had the panel discussion with Brother Charlie when he was teaching through his unit on unity and diversity, one of the topics that Charlie and I had talked about and some others was the topic of social justice. And as I began to research this topic, my wife will testify to this. I said, there is no way that we can get through this in 20, 25 minutes in a Sunday evening. So I'm not even going to attempt to do that. We'll begin to look at this topic, and hopefully we can maybe develop a format where we can delve a little deeper into this. How many of you today, as a result of what's going on, have thought a little more deeply about social justice? Anybody? Wow. Okay. Good. Good. So if I were to ask you, I mean, what do you think of when you think of social justice? Someone be brave enough to give me an answer. I know that that's, again, it's a hard topic to kind of put down in a single sentence, but what's the thought that comes to your mind? Some of the thoughts that come to your mind. Okay, yeah, this is an idea that the social justice movement has taken, and I will say in some ways has unjustly used that privilege. Okay, but at the same time, on the other end of the spectrum, I don't think any of us should argue that if you're white in America, it has afforded you some privileges, and maybe again some privileges that you have never thought about or maybe you're not thinking about now, because these privileges might not be something that stand out to you. Okay, wow, I experienced white privilege today, okay? But you may have and weren't aware of it, because again, I think we can say that whites have held a majority position in a lot of influential places throughout our history, okay? And primarily kind of a Western and Eastern European kind of approach to life in our United States. Most of the early immigrants were from that part of the world, and I think it still continues to be that way. So, yeah, I think that can be a part of it. Somebody else, what you think of when you think of social justice? Lisa?
Equality.
Okay, yeah. Equality for all people, regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of where they come from, regardless of their social class, all right? I think it is only just and right that people should be treated equally. In fact, our Declaration of Independence opens with those words, doesn't it? We didn't do such a good job of necessarily following them in all cases, but they're grand and glorious, and I think words that have allowed culture in America to progress, and it continues to progress, okay? And I think that's a good thing. Not in every way, but in some ways. Anybody else? Have any of you ever experienced what you might define as social injustice? Chris? Yeah, we're okay with it too, Chris. Yeah, so God can use even things that are not necessarily just to see his will accomplished. The environment we find ourselves living in today, as I was studying this, I came across the words of Thomas Paine, who penned them in 1776, and he made up a small pamphlet to kind of try to to raise awareness and raise support for the ongoing war of independence. And the name of the pamphlet was called The American Crisis. And he opened this pamphlet with these words: "These are the times that try men's souls." And I think all of us probably would say that since March of 2020, these have been the times that have tried our souls, because we have the onset of the pandemic, then we had, again, the murder of George Floyd in the Twin Cities, and that set off a whole chain of events that continues on and on and on. Even to this day, there are protests taking place in cities as a result of this, and this has affected us personally, because just south of us in Kenosha, we saw a lot of this these take place. I was thinking about myself and just about social unrest within our nation, and I was thinking in my lifetime. Can you think of some events in your lifetime that have caused social unrest, other than what we currently are going through? Well, yeah, huge. 9/11, man. I mean, that shook the whole nation, right? I mean, that's one that I think all of us, pretty much all of us, okay, at least the adults in the room, were here for. And I'm sure if I would ask you where you were on 9/11, you could recall where you were. I certainly can, all right? My first day of work at Rogers Paint and Paper. I'm up on the roof laying down tarps, and Chris comes running around and says, "You need to come down here. Chris, Roger wants us at the van." And so we ran around the van, and sure enough, we're listening to the radio. And I remember my first thoughts: I got to call my wife. I got to find out that they're safe. Even though, again, they're miles away from this event, your thoughts turn immediately to the safety of your family. Yeah, that event rocked our nation, and so caused a great deal of social unrest. And I would say, in the wake of it, social injustice. Right? There were numerous Arab people of Arab descent, or look like Arabs, who experienced a great deal of social injustice during that period. All right, so I thought about my own life, and the first event that I can remember very clearly, okay, I was playing on the playground. It was November of 1963, all right, and the teacher comes running out and says, "You need to come into the school." And so all of a sudden, all the kids are taken off the playground, okay, into the school, and the principal announces that the school's going to be dismissed. All right, they're going to dismiss us home, and that an event had taken place, and I can't recall if they told us then. I remember going home, walking in the door, and my mother weeping, okay, because President John F. Kennedy had been assassinated, and that event sticks in my mind. Other events stick in my mind. All right, I was around in the long, hot summer of 1967 when riots broke out all across the nation in cities. In fact, at the city I lived in, Milwaukee, I can remember sneaking out after curfew with the rubber-tired armored vehicles and the National Guard all over our neighborhood and around the city, enforcing the curfew, okay, and North Avenue just being burnt down. A lot of sections of the city burnt down. My father, who was an auxiliary policeman, went to get my grandmother and my great aunt, who lived in a neighborhood that was pretty bad, coming back and the back window of the car being smashed in. All right, but he got my grandmother and my great aunt home to our place and safe. And so I remember the social unrest of that. There was a long period in our country of social unrest, and some of us who are around my age will remember that. What was that?
Vietnam.
Okay, and you had protests taking place everywhere on college campuses throughout our nation. And I would say the protest was much more widespread than it is now, okay? And much greater social unrest within our country. In the wake of that, you had the resignation of President Nixon as a result of the Watergate scandal, okay? And that shook the nation. If we move a little further down the road, you had the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy in April and June of 1968. So There's been all kinds of events that have taken place within our country that have really rocked us as a nation and have created social unrest and sometimes have brought to light, brought to surface the fact that we do have social injustice taking place within our own nation. To say there's not social injustice really is to bury your heads in the sand. It's true. But we have weathered those times as a nation, and I am praying that we continue to weather those times as a nation. But I think, and something I see too, and have been amazed at, is that the topic of social injustice has taken over what area that we all are on? Social media. Yeah. I mean, it is all over social media. And I've been somewhat amazed as I've read, and I'm prattling a little bit, but just bear with me because, again, this is a long subject. I've been somewhat amazed at the input of Christians who, in some cases, I call them Gnostic experts, okay? They write as if they have incredible insight and knowledge into some of these very complex issues. And what has dismayed me is how little scripture I see filtering the comments and kind of the judgments and the assessments of what is taking place within our nation. I see a lot of anger. I see a lot of fear. I see a lot of emotion. But I don't see much biblical clarity as a result of this. And that's, you know, been a little bit dismaying to me as we've looked at this. Now, again, tonight I want to briefly, and I mean very briefly, kind of begin to talk about the topic of social justice. And I think we all would agree that when we come to this topic, our understanding of social justice needs to be defined where? By the culture? By our own experiences? I'm not saying those aren't inputs we should consider, right? But Jacob held up his Bible, and I amen that. We need to go to the scriptures and look at the scriptures. And so as I thought about this, I thought, okay, where did social injustice begin? Who can answer that question? Where do we see the first act of social injustice? Yeah. Adam and Eve against God. Okay, that was social injustice of the highest magnitude. I don't know of a greater act of social injustice than the sin of Adam and Eve. When you think of the social environment that they had been placed into and then their rebellion against it, it's like it blows your mind. But again, we know, by what the scriptures teach us, that we all sin. We all would have failed in that particular environment, and therefore we are all guilty as a result of that. Now, it's interesting. Where do we see a prediction of social injustice first in the Bible? Okay. Elaborate. Okay. Yeah, if you go to Genesis chapter 3, and let's just go there, okay? If you have your Bibles or your media devices, whatever you have, let's just go there. And we go, and Jacob talks about verses 15 and 16, where he says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Now, an application, I'm not saying it's the interpretation, but an application of this, okay, is we're going to have tension here. We're going to have a battle. And I think this is defining a spiritual warfare that has been raging since the fall. And where God tells Eve, okay, that your seed, all right, and this is a reference to Jesus Christ eventually, but again, the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, which is Satan himself, that there's going to be this long and cataclysmic battle between these two forces. And I think one of the primary results of this battle is social injustice. Okay, it's one of the results of sin. Then we get more particular, and where we find God telling the husband and the wife, all right, this is what's going to happen in your home. This is what's going to happen between men and women. The man will sinfully use his physical strength, his ability to dominate you. He will use that to dominate you. Okay? Has that happened? Is it still happening? Absolutely. It is. It also says the woman will desire your place, will desire you, which I agree with Jacob's interpretation. That means that the woman is going to desire the place of dominance, the place of rule. And there's going to be ways that she's going to go about doing that. And I think history and even Proverbs and the scriptures teach us that that can be by one of two means. And I think there's a primary motivator, and I'm going to be careful how I speak here. But the seductive speech of a woman can be used to rule a man. All right? If I can put it this way and not be clear, okay, the woman can use her body as a weapon in relationships. And that happens, has, continues to this day. And so we have here what we might call social injustice in the most important institution ever created, the family. Okay? There's tension in families. Between husbands and wives. Does it stop there? What's the next incident of social injustice?
Cain and Abel.
And there you have language used by God that's similar to that helps us to define what is being said about the woman. You have God telling Cain, listen, Cain, sin is at the door of your heart. And it's seeking entrance, and its desire is to rule you. You have to fight that. And he doesn't. And we know that when we back up, verse 6, it says of chapter 4, the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you. You must rule over it. So we have this theme of rule and dominance, all right? Very prevalent in social justice speech. And we know that Cain was unsuccessful and that he chose to sin, and he rised up and created what we might call the greatest social injustice of all. He murdered his brother. He took his life. And we understand that one of the first judicial acts of God, in a sense, is to condemn this social injustice. That if you shed the blood of an individual in premeditated murder, your blood will be required of you. And so you have God enacting social justice through a judicial act, okay, and saying if you kill somebody, a premeditated murder, your life will be required. Capital punishment is biblical. But then we get to chapter 6, right? And what does chapter 6 tell us about the human race? Where has it gone? Has it come since this time? Yeah, near total corruption. How many when you think about this, this just hit me again. Now, I don't know what the population of the world was. I don't. But it was a lot of people, okay? And so you have the population of the world, and as God looked at their hearts, what did he see? only wickedness continually, only evil continually. The depravity of man was robust, okay? And it was threatening the very creation of God. And so God intervened in an act of what we might call social justice and judgment upon the world. And 8 individuals out of the entire population are saved. 8. Okay? And it's only Noah that is called just out of this. So we have, when we think about our worldview and our definition of social injustice, we always have to define social injustice, okay, that its root problem is what? Sin. The sin in individual human hearts. Now, it may express itself in systems and systems of oppression, and it has, and it will continue to do so. But we cannot bypass the fact that what is really evil, systems of evil, are the fruit of wicked hearts. That's what they are. And so if we attempt to bypass the wickedness of man's heart and simply go after systems of oppression, we're never going to be successful. That's why I believe, again, at the heart of social justice is the gospel. Because it is, I'm not saying it's the only thing we should do, but it's at the foundation of everything we should do in our fight, in our cause of social justice. And I think the Bible presents that Christians have a cause to promote social justice. But if we get away from the gospel, we get ourselves in trouble. And this is not an easy conversation, because we have a lot of different ideas and attitudes within Christianity on how social justice should be exercised within the church. But I will say this, I think as we look at this tonight, we can never lose sight of the fact that the core problem, the core cause of social injustice, is the individual depravity of human beings, you and me. And that the most important institution to promote social justice is what? Where is the real cure for social justice going to begin within any culture? Church. Well, the church can help this, and is intended to. But what do we have sitting here tonight? Families, okay? I would say to you, and I would argue from going back to the definition where social justice really kind of began, which was against God, but ultimately we see its first prediction of taking place is within families. And I would argue at the root of all social injustice throughout the world, again, is the dominance and the destruction and the undermining, and we see this especially in America, of the family. And so our cause for social justice begins, and this is, I think Lisa's right, okay, the church, when we look at one of the church, again, the church has a primary responsibility of preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ to the whole world. But the greatest impact that the gospel has, because I believe the smallest but most powerful institution yet inhabiting the planet is the family. When you have dads and moms and children living, again, in regeneration, ultimately, but even before our children are saved, we are called to present a biblical model of social justice to our children, right? That we treat them, I'm not going to say fairly, but we do attempt to treat them equally. Now, that's going to be different with different children. But we're not given the privilege of showing favoritism, of privilege, unless it's earned. So when we talk about social justice, I think we always have to remember that our definition of it has to find its roots in the Bible, and the root of social injustice is the depraved heart of man. There are ways to control that, but the greatest way and the eternal way that we have to change the human heart is the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I believe that is why we see the primary mission of the church is to propel the gospel. And now again, I think we can do that effectively sometimes in social justice environments if the gospel leads the way on that. So, but as we continue on in the scriptures, okay, after the flood and Noah and the ark settle, and Noah and his family get off the ark, and they are again commissioned by God to populate the earth, and the next scene we're brought to is where? Where's the next significant scene in the Bible story? Someone say it?
Babel.
Okay, what happens at Babel? Okay. They try to build a tower. I don't know that it's to God. I think it is a God. I think the tower is a God. Okay. They remember the flood. And so they're going to build this tower so tall that they can seek sanctuary, all right, from it. And they're united in this. And God comes down and says, listen, whatever their heart desires to do, nothing will stop them. And the condition of man's heart, again, going back, is evil. And so the evil designs of people, again, are going to be, it's going to be, in a human sense, unstoppable. And God's not going to place himself in a position again. And he promised he would not judge the world in that way. And so he confounds the languages. And now what happens as a result of confounding the languages? Okay, yeah. That's how we get ethnic groups. I don't know if we get races. We get ethnic groups, okay? We get people who speak different languages, who move out throughout the world and create different cultures. And so we have different ethnic groups rise up. But there's only one race, right? There is only one race. It's the human race. Okay. And so you have ethnic groups spread out and begin to settle in different places. And all of a sudden, as human history begins to be recorded, what is most recorded in human history? Wars. Okay? Wars. Border wars, ethnic wars, okay? All kinds of social injustice begins to percolate and happen. And you have nation after nation appear to rise up, and although there appear to be individual Christians, followers of Yahweh within these cultures, we don't see what we would call, at least not from the scriptures, a predominantly Yahweh culture, do we? But God is going to remedy that, isn't he? Because in Genesis chapter 12, what does he do there? He calls Abram, okay? And he gives Abram some promises, that, and we know these, that God's going to make of Abraham a great nation. He's going to multiply his seed as the sands of the sea, and that through Abraham's seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. A reference to Messiah. Okay. And so we have these promises, and through a series of sovereign events, we know Jacob, because of Joseph, ends up in Egypt. Things are okay for a while, but then the Pharaoh who knows Joseph dies, and a new Pharaoh from a new line rises up, and they don't know Joseph. And they look at the Jews, and all of a sudden the Jews, rather than a very productive and massive workforce, now become a threat, and they bring them into bondage and into slavery, and they exercise great social injustice against these people. Until Moses comes along. All right, and Moses goes in, and under the power of God, he delivers these people from Egypt. And if you read, again, the book, we went through the book of Exodus and the book of Deuteronomy and all of the Pentateuch, you see numerous places where the Jews are reminded that God has brought them out of slavery. And then God takes them to Mount Sinai, and what does God do at Mount Sinai? And we're going to end here tonight, but we'll pick this up. Yes. Okay. He establishes what I'll call a national land covenant with these people. All right? He makes a promise to them. This promise was given to Abraham that they're going to occupy a portion of real estate. And when they occupy this portion of real estate, I am going to give you the laws that are going to govern you as you live in this land. And if you keep those laws, you will prosper in the land. If you break those laws, you will lose the land. So I think it's always important to remember as we interpret the Mosaic Covenant, we can never interpret the Mosaic Covenant as purely a moral covenant between Israel and Yahweh. It's a land covenant. The law was never intended to be a means to salvation. It was a means to justice in the land. It was a means to be a light to the Gentiles as we look at that. And tonight we won't take the time, but as you go through this, the Ten Commandments, if we look at those, if the world would obey the Ten Commandments, we would have what? We would have social justice, okay? So we're gonna leave it there. But again, I want you to understand how significant the Ten Commandments are when it comes to social justice. Our legal system in this country, which was built on the British legal system, which was built on the idea of objective law, really upon the idea of and the foundation of the Ten Commandments, is where we get the Judeo-Christian ethic of law. And it has served us well and continues to serve us well. But again, it can't overcome, right? The law cannot overcome the sinful heart, even the perfect law of God, because of man, not because of the law, but because of man's sinful bent. It cannot overcome our sin. And so social injustices continue in our world. But I'm just, again, I feel like it's important because there's a lot of theories of social justice that are out there today. And a lot of these theories have influenced the church, okay? They really have, on how the church views social justice and how social justice is going to be exercised or should be exercised. And I think we have to be very careful in our understanding of how God defines social justice and how God defines the exercise of social justice, which is what we're going to look at the next time we have an opportunity. Again, I'm going to try to create a format to be able to do that as we continue this. So any observations, questions? Yeah, in Mark's Sunday School class, we're talking about apologetics, developing a biblical worldview, and I think this is where our biblical worldview becomes very, very important. In regards to the days in which we find ourselves, because you may be having conversations with people about social justice, and I hope you do. And I think it can create an incredible platform for this knowledge, okay? And particularly the gospel, as we look at. Did you have your hand up? Oh, okay. All right. Let's close in prayer, okay? And I want to thank you for coming out. Father.